Good afternoon and welcome to the April meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Hedges Hall, Point Lookout in Northport, Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience reaching us through the stations of Maine Public, mpbn.org. I am Tom DeMarco, filling in for Mac DeFord, our president. This is forum meeting number 398. Forum was founded in 1983, now in its 35th year, maybe more, of bringing you on a monthly basis informed speakers on all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomacy. Details about past and upcoming programs available at our website, midcoastforum.org. To guide us through the very complicated topic of nuclear deterrence and nonproliferation in this very complicated age, we're delighted to have Dr. John Harvey with us today. He's a man who has spent his entire adult life trying to keep you safe, to keep all of us safe from nuclear incidents. And that means war, accidents, terrorism, the whole gamut. And having heard him speak on that subject, I came away with the feeling that in order to fill that role, he's got to be 50%, at least 50% a physicist, which he is. He's a PhD physicist. At least 50% a diplomat. At least 50% a military strategist, and 50% a philosopher, in order to figure out the complex set of values that our adversaries and would-be adversaries, that causes them to do what they do. I also came away, and I think you will as you listen to him, with the sense that John is exactly the right person to be in that role to keep us all safe. John Harvey, welcome.
Maine Mid-Coastal Forum on Foreign Relations. I'm very pleased to be here. Attorney General Mills, Senator Hall, Ambassador Mendelson. I want to thank you for inviting me to speak here today. My hosts, the folks, the connection with me in this organization is George and Karen Look, who I've known for most of my career, and we've worked closely on comparable programs. Karen and I worked together on Mr. Obama's 2010 nuclear posture review of U.S. nuclear weapons programs, policies, and postures. Both George and Karen worked closely with Rose Gottemuller, who was our Assistant Secretary of State for Arms Control in Mr. Obama's administration, and she led the negotiations with the Russians on the New START Treaty for reducing nuclear arsenals for both Russia and the United States early in Mr. Obama's first term. I want to begin with a brief story. When my mother, who is now 91, asked me a few years ago to explain Mr. Obama's nuclear posture review, I boiled down these 49 pages of text to two sentences. I said, "The president wants to get rid of nuclear weapons globally, but realizes that this will take a long time to achieve, possibly many decades." That's the first sentence. Second sentence is, "Until we no longer need them, he wants to ensure that we have a smaller but safe, reliable, and effective nuclear stockpile and nuclear forces." My mother's reply, "Well, that sounds sensible." But I go on and say, the president not only is not happy with simply contemplating a long-term future goal, he actually wants to take concrete steps down that path in the near term that will lead us there, and he seeks as well to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. national security. I'm going to talk a little bit more about Obama because Mr. Trump hasn't been in office long enough to really understand where he's headed, and I have some recommendations at the end that I will offer for him. My mother said, "Well, that's even better." My mother is well to the left of me, although she's not quite a pacifist. She reluctantly accepts the fact that most of my career has focused on the safe, secure, and effective part of Mr. Obama's equation, not the get rid of them part. That said, she is a huge fan of Rose Gottemuller's. For achieving one of those concrete steps towards that long-term goal, getting New START concluded with the Russians and ratified by the U.S. Senate, which was no small feat, and she will be thrilled to hear that I was invited to participate in this meeting by two of Rose's most trusted lieutenants in that effort. Thank you, George and Karen. For the next 15 to 20 minutes, I want to walk you through the ongoing debate on the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. national security, and highlight some of the choices for the Trump administration regarding nuclear weapons and nuclear modernization. Then I'm going to offer a brief show and tell to make some of the story about modernization somewhat more concrete. One of my colleagues, and you may remember him as a former head of the Central Intelligence Agency and also a high official in the Defense Department, is John Deutsch. He's written eloquently about the opposing worldviews on nuclear weapons and their potential use in conflict. Noting that these weapons exist today and cannot be wished away, he identifies two competing visions. the idealistic and the pragmatist. The idealistic view is to work diligently for the complete elimination of nuclear weapons. The pragmatic view is to accept the existence of these weapons in order to maintain their deterrent value while working to reduce the inherent risks of possessing them. More specifically, Dr. Deutsch argues, the idealist believes that any inventory of nuclear weapons, no matter how small, presents inevitable risk of catastrophic accident or unauthorized use or theft. The pragmatist believes it is impossible to reverse the knowledge of how nuclear weapons are made and to reach agreement on their elimination as long as there are irreconcilable political differences and existential security concerns among nations. In acknowledging these two worldviews, I also want to make clear that I'm solidly in the pragmatist school. I think President Obama was also a pragmatist, but gave voice in a very effective way to the concerns of the idealists, and in doing so helped bridge the gap a bit between these two world visions. After nearly two decades of confusion and divisive debate about the post-Cold War, Soviet Union fell apart in 1987, 1988. What is the mission of these things after the end of the Cold War? Mr. Obama's team crafted a fragile bipartisan consensus. There's not much in Washington today that's bipartisan. Almost everything in Washington has a partisan component to it. The one thing where we have some agreement among the Democrats and the Republicans is that we need these things and we need to modernize them at some level. Mr. Obama's team put that together based on the concepts embodied in his 2009 Prague speech, which is the short version of which I told my mom. It is critical that the new administration, Mr. Trump's team, seek ways to nurture and strengthen that consensus and not to undermine it, for example, with a few ill-timed or imprecisely worded tweets. The rhetoric on these things in nuclear must be subtle and restrained if one seeks to advance a program that will survive the legislative process. I will address a few key questions. What was the role of U.S. nuclear weapons during the Cold War? What is their role today? What about global elimination? Is it feasible in the near term? If not elimination, what have we been doing and have we been doing to reduce nuclear dangers? And what needs to be done to modernize the aging triad, our nuclear triad of forces, and how much will it cost? And I want to talk about the evolution of the global security environment. During the Cold War, there was substantial debate on the margins of policy circles, but generally, few questioned the need for the United States to have viable nuclear forces to deter nuclear attacks against it and its allies. But more than that, U.S. nuclear forces help prevent large-scale conventional conflicts of the sort, World War I, World War II, that led to tens of millions of deaths in the first half of the 20th century. Simply put, major conventional war now involved a huge risk of escalation to nuclear conflict, and the incalculable downside risks of such escalation induced caution in potential adversaries. Their potential use was so horrendous that nations became more cautious than they would possibly normally have been in dealing with conflict and dealing with differences. Very importantly, U.S. deployments of nuclear weapons in Europe and the Allied engagement and burden sharing associated with those deployments were a major factor linking together the security of the United States with that of its European allies and in preventing war during some very, very dangerous times. Since the end of the Cold War, the catastrophic nuclear exchange involving perhaps hundreds or thousands of nuclear weapons is much less likely, we all agree. And U.S. nuclear weapons are increasingly seen, as they have been all along, as weapons of last resort. But today's security environment is more varied, less predictable, and much more dependent on local and regional factors. Indeed, regional tensions and the potential for major conflict have not gone away. Nuclear weapons remain a factor in the security calculations of several nations, some with increasing emphasis. U.S. security guarantees to allies, to NATO, to Japan, to the Republic of Korea, are sometimes referenced as the nuclear umbrella, and they have received a lot of attention lately in light of the evolving security threats both in Europe and in Asia. The credibility of U.S. security guarantees has allowed many allies not to acquire their own nuclear forces, even though most have the capacity, the technical capacity to do so. The U.S. nuclear umbrella, therefore, has been an important mechanism for nonproliferation. It's not one that's that widely recognized. Russia. The 900-pound gorilla in the security environment today is Russia. Many of us were hopeful that with the end of the Cold War, Russia would become a much more responsible member of the community of nations. The fall of the Soviet Union was accompanied by great economic and political turmoil. Russia reached out to the West, and relations entered a period of some reasonable stability. When the Twin Towers fell, Mr. Putin was one of the first leaders to call George Bush and offer help. Russia facilitated NATO military operations in Afghanistan by helping to secure, or at least not oppose, supply lines through its former republic. Mr. Obama sought a reset of relations with Russia to further strengthen cooperation. The U.S. and Russia worked together to complete the New START Treaty, conclude the Iran deal, and get rid of most, but obviously not all, of Syria's chemical weapons. More recently, Russia has rejected the post-Cold War order, as reflected by its illegal annexation from Ukraine of Crimea and efforts to destabilizing other sovereign states, as we have read about in the newspapers very recently. Russia, in my view, not ISIS or even North Korea, presents the most pressing near-term security threat for the United States. Mr. Putin has given increased prominence to nuclear forces and to brandishing them to seek to intimidate his adversaries. We must expect that even though he conveyed early on the prospect of reconciliation with the new administration, that he will test Mr. Trump, probe him probably on connection with NATO. He will test our security commitments to our allies. NATO must plan for such possible scenarios. First, to understand quickly when a member is coming under covert assault, as happened in Ukraine, and second, to provide a firm, timely, and united response. Deterring a hostile Russia thus remains a focus, and unfortunately an increasing one, for U.S. nuclear and conventional forces. If, as part of its evolving nuclear strategy, Russia really believes that it could use a limited use of nuclear weapons to escalate, quote, escalate its way to victory, for example, in reoccupying one of the Baltic states, Lithuania, Estonia, Latvia, which are now a member of NATO, then it must be set straight. No conceivable advantage, an incalculable downside risk, would accrue from any nuclear use of Russia against NATO. Mr. Trump's team must determine whether ongoing modernization programs for our forces need to be reworked, or existing declaratory policy, and that's basically what we say about the conditions under which we would or would not use nuclear weapons, an existing declaratory policy clarified to ensure this objective. 10 years ago, few would have imagined the events of the past 3 years in Ukraine. Today, it must inform our thinking about future conflict in that region and a continuing role for deterrence. Other elements of U.S. and allied nuclear security are affected by treaties. The Non-Proliferation Treaty, signed by the United States in 1970, imposes obligations on the five nuclear weapon states under the treaty, that is U.S., U.K., France, Russia, and China. There were the states under the treaty that were the nuclear weapon states. And it also imposes obligations on the remaining states who agree not to acquire nuclear arsenals. And the basic deal is, you guys have them, but we want you to eventually get rid of them. And if we make progress on that, then we won't get them. So the non-nuclear weapon states have a deal with the nuclear weapon states is, we won't get them, but we want you eventually to get rid of them. And that's reflected in Article 6 of the treaty. And I'm going to just quote this to you because it's an important means by which we have to address every few years in negotiations in the UN. Article 6 calls on the parties to pursue negotiations in good faith on effective measures related to the cessation of the nuclear arms race on an early date, and to nuclear disarmament, that is elimination, and on a treaty on general and complete disarmament under strict and effective international control. So it links nuclear disarmament with getting rid of all military forces. That's what we call general and complete disarmament. So there's a linkage there. While nuclear disarmament has not been achieved, over the past 30 years, remarkable progress has been made on the path to that ultimate goal. The nuclear arms race has, in fact, been halted. The United States has reduced its nuclear forces and nuclear weapons stockpile in a consistent fashion through both unilateral and bilateral measures, including working cooperatively with allies and partners such as Russia to further reduce the threats and associated dangers. Let me give you the laundry list of what we've done, just because it needs to be said, because some folks don't really realize the great progress we've made over the past 30 years. Arms control treaties between the U.S. and Russia have led to substantial reductions in nuclear forces, both long-range forces and intermediate-range forces. The START process with Russia has reduced strategic nuclear weapons accountable, we call them. It's not the whole, everyone, but the ones that we deploy on forces from about 10,000 to about 1,500 in the New START treaty. Today, the U.S. nuclear stockpile is one quarter its size at the end of the Cold War. And I'll show you a little chart about that as we move forward. This dramatic transformation is most evident in the elimination of many, many thousands of short-range tactical nuclear warheads, which are now at one-tenth of Cold War levels for the United States. The only nuclear weapons that remain in the U.S. stockpile today are those carried by the nuclear triad of intercontinental ballistic missiles, submarine-launched ballistic missiles, and heavy bombers. And I'm going to speak a little bit more on that shortly. Adjustments in the alert posture, that is the readiness of forces to be executed. Adjustments and reductions in the alert posture have made forces safer and more secure against accidental or unauthorized use. The U.S. has maintained since 1992 a unilateral moratorium on nuclear testing. That moratorium on testing is reflected in the U.S. signature of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty back in the late 1990s. That treaty has never been ratified by the U.S. Senate. Threat reduction cooperation with Russia, now sadly ended by Russia, has made remarkable progress in destroying nuclear delivery systems and securing weapons usable materials, plutonium and highly rich uranium, further reducing the risk of loss of control of these nuclear assets. If terrorists ever acquired nuclear weapons, we should not expect that they would be deterred from using them. The strong record of achievement demonstrates that the United States is serious about its Non-Proliferation Treaty Article 6 commitment. Sadly, it often does not go far enough to satisfy the idealists who want to move much faster towards global nuclear elimination. Let's talk about elimination for a moment. The idealists argue that the Article 6 commitment of the Non-Proliferation Treaty commits the five nuclear weapon states to eventual elimination, and indeed it does. But the idealists want the U.S. to move out now and take the lead in making that happen. Pragmatists see nuclear disarmament as an aspiration, possibly a long-term goal, something that might be achieved were the world to evolve into a much different place than it is today. Indeed, it is useful to consider the international conditions that would cause even the pragmatists to agree to forego nuclear weapons. Perhaps it would entail a tradition built up over many decades where disputes were settled peacefully, where there was no threat of conflict, much less world war or nuclear war, where nations as a result took unilateral steps to reduce their arsenals. After all, nuclear weapons are the symptom, not the cause of conflict, and where there was increased transparency about military programs and activities. It could involve an increased willingness of states to forego certain nationalistic tendencies and cede a degree of state sovereignty to the global commons. Certainly, and all of this is my speculation, but I'm trying to think about the conditions under which we actually might think about getting rid of them. Certainly, this is a security environment much more benign than today's, where several states are increasing, not reducing, reliance on their nuclear forces. Even if seemingly fanciful, it is worthwhile to consider such a future because it establishes a goal worth seeking. Until these conditions are met, however, it would serve the U.S. well to retain its military capabilities, including its nuclear capabilities, to hedge a very uncertain future. Let me turn to the nukes that we have today and what we need to do, or what I think we need to do. Let me presume for the moment that based on my arguments and concerns about the global security environment, I have convinced some of you that now is not the time to think about getting rid of these things. But if we are to retain these forces for a few more decades at least, the Trump team will need to make some difficult decisions. Specifically, we are on the cusp of a cycle of nuclear forces modernization last encountered in the 1980s. Every 30 years or so, this bill comes due. Indeed, we have delayed moving forward on modernization of key systems for too long, partly as a result of our hope that some of these programs might not be needed if the world were to evolve in a different direction. Today's nuclear warheads, nuclear delivery systems, and the nuclear command and control system are what I would call, quote, on the edge of the cliff of performance. Ash Carter, our former Secretary of Defense, said either, quote, something along the lines of either we fix these systems or we need to get rid of them because they are on the pathway, not there yet, but they're on the pathway to becoming ineffective and in some cases unsafe. It is not so much that we need to create new systems, new nuclear weapon systems, or new military capabilities, or acquire those new capabilities, but simply replace what we have today with modern variants. The first order of business is to ensure that the existing triad, consisting of Minuteman III ICBMs, submarines deployed with submarine-launched ballistic missiles, the B-2 and the B-52 bombers, remain safe and reliable until they can be replaced. Regarding the follow-on systems, we need to do a number of things now, reasonably soon. By that I mean over the next 10 to 20 years. Because these programs take a long time to realize, you have to start now if you want to get something in 20 years. Modernize the sea-based deterrent with a new submarine to replace the Ohio-class ballistic missile submarines that are currently deployed since the 1980s. Develop a follow-on ICBM to replace the aging Minuteman III. Move forward on fielding a new nuclear-capable strategic bomber. Field a long-range standoff missile to replace the current air-launched cruise missile. Ensure continuing ability to meet deterrence commitments to allies with a nuclear-capable joint strike fighter. We call it the F-35. With regard to the warheads, we need to continue to advance life extension programs. Not build new warheads, but extend the life of the warheads that we have today that are delivered by these platforms, these delivery systems that I've called out. And finally, we need to modernize the nuclear command and control system, consisting of radars for detection of a launch against the United States, the communication systems that would need to be established to deal with the potential for a nuclear employment by the United States. Unfortunately, all of these bills will come due at about the same time, resulting in what we call in Washington the acquisition bow wave, which will peak in the 2020s. These costs, however, represent a relatively small fraction of the total defense budget. Basically, the costs that we're talking about are about 3% of the defense budget today, rising to about 5% of the defense budget at the peak of the bow wave. And the defense budget is roughly $600 billion. So 10% is $60 billion, and 5% is $30 billion. So we're talking $30 billion a year over the next several years to sustain and modernize our forces. Many of us think that's affordable. The modernization program was put in place by Mr. Obama mostly over the period of his second term. Mr. Trump must decide whether to advance this program or do something different in its place. We will learn a lot more in a few months as Mr. Trump's own nuclear posture review, just kicked off last week, gets up ahead of steam. This is an artist's rendition of the Enola Gay, which is the B-29 bomber that dropped the first nuclear weapon on Hiroshima in August of 1945. Here's the bomb that was dropped. It weighed several thousand pounds, consisting of what we call a gun-assembled design, about 20,000 tons of TNT equivalent. It's a picture of the bomb in the loading bay. Here is the picture of the Enola Gay being backed up to be able to load the bomb into the bomb bay. And here's the devastation that that bomb caused in Hiroshima. So one of the things we want to convey to the people we speak to generally who have an idea about these things, but maybe not some of the specifics, just the horrendous damage that can be caused with a relatively small nuclear weapon. That was the start of the nuclear age. Now let me just trace. This chart here shows on the vertical axis the number of warheads in the U.S. stockpile, and on the bottom axis it goes from 1945 to 2009. And basically what you see here is an extraordinary ramp up from zero in 1945, or two in 1945, to, by about 1960, 30,000 nuclear weapons. We were producing thousands of nuclear weapons a year during that period. The enterprise was an industrial enterprise. Well, over a period of time it sort of was a little flat. And then right around the late 1980s and early 1990s, it took a real steep drop. And part of this was George H.W. Bush's decision to get rid of a large amount of tactical nuclear, short-range nuclear weapons. And then George W. Bush, that second drop-off, is George W. Bush's decisions to retire a large number of weapons after the Moscow Treaty that he negotiated with Russia. So now we're down to somewhere today about 4,000 nuclear weapons. So we've made a large reduction in the stockpile, and President Obama, before he left office, said we could go even further, but he was not willing to go further unless the Russians were willing to join us. And the Russians have shown no interest in joining us further to reduce nuclear arsenals. Here's where we base nuclear weapons. We have two submarine bases, one in the Atlantic in Kings Bay and one in the Pacific near Seattle, Washington. We base intercontinental ballistic missiles in the Midwest and bombers I did a little search before I came out here, and in Google, nuclear weapons in Maine. And the Loring Air Force Base up near Presque Isle, till 1994, was the 42nd Bombardment Wing of the Strategic Air Command and deployed B-52 G bombers with nuclear weapons and tankers that would refuel these bombers on their way to targets. So Maine played a role in sharing the burden of owning nuclear weapons for a period of time. There were a lot more bases back in the day than there are today. As I say, we have about 3 bases with bombers, 3 with ICBMs, and 2 for submarines. Here's the Ohio-class submarine that was deployed since about the 1980s. These submarines carry ballistic missiles. Here's the ballistic missile they carry being launched from under the water, Trident II submarine launch ballistic missile. Here's the Minuteman III ICBM. You see it being launched. There's a test range where these things are launched out in Vandenberg Air Force Base in California, and they fly to the Pacific, and they're monitored as they go along to ensure their reliability and effectiveness. We'll have about 400 of these deployed in silos in the Midwest. And here are 2 lieutenants who are in a launch control center for a Minuteman III missile. And you see there are 2 of them there because they both have to turn a key to be able to launch the missile. One of them can't, and the keys are far enough apart that one of them can't shoot his partner and then decide he wants to launch a nuclear missile on his own. Here are the nuclear weapons that we deploy on ballistic missiles. The first 2 on the left are for ICBMs. The ones on the right are for submarine launched ballistic missiles. And the numbers are sort of random, but if you look at it, the warheads are called Ws, W78, 87, 76, 88. Roughly, in which they were first deployed, are the numbers. Here's the B-52 on a base at Minot Air Force Base. These were the airplanes that were fielded up at Loring Air Force Base. Here's a cruise missile in flight. This is a what we call an air-launch cruise missile, which carries a nuclear warhead, which is at the end of its, coming to the end of its service life, and it will need to be replaced. That's part of our modernization program. Here's the B-2, quite an unusual-looking aircraft. It is styled in a way to minimize what we call radar cross-section, the ability of enemy air defense radars to detect and track this airplane is remarkably low. But because air defenses improve, you can't keep it that way forever. And so this will have to be modernized as well, and I'm going to show you another artist's conception of what the thing is that's going to replace this. Here, you get a little bit more of a feel for the size of the aircraft as the B-2 being prepared for flight. Here's the artist's conception of the follow-on to the B-2, and it's now been called the B-21. On the first glance, it looks the same as the B-2, but there's a lot of difference in terms of its stealth, its ability to minimize its radar detection from air defenses, and it's something that is just, we think, will be fielded sometime in the next 10 to 15 years, and the program is just getting underway. We also deploy aircraft in Europe. We call these dual-capable aircraft because they're both conventional and nuclear-capable. And we deploy these things in Europe as a demonstration of our commitment to the security of the NATO alliance. We also have allies in certain countries who fly their own aircraft, have a capability to fly their own aircraft with U.S. nuclear weapons. Here are the air-delivered nuclear weapons, that is, those weapons carried by bombers. We have 4 of them. We have 2 variants of what we call the B-61 bomb. And that program right now is undergoing a life extension program so that these 5 different variants, we call them the 3, 4s, and 10s, 7, 11s of the B-61, are going to be 1 variant, 1 bomb. And we will save money, and we won't have to have all of these different types of nuclear weapons out there. We have a B-83 bomb, which is slated for retirement. And we have the warhead for the air-launched cruise missile, which is called the W-80. So it's not just the delivery systems. It's the, by the way, this is the role of the Department of Energy to produce and life extend our warheads. The Department of Defense sets the requirements for the Department of Energy on what they need. This looks like Air Force One, but it's not. You see that little bubble at the top? That's a UHF antenna. So that this airplane is the nuclear command and control center when the U.S. comes under attack. It takes off and it flies around, and it can basically can control the forces from this airplane. This is, the president doesn't fly this airplane. He has his own airplane, but this airplane can communicate wherever the president is. And so part of our nuclear forces is the command and control, And without the command and control, you don't have the capability to either execute these forces or recall them once they're executed. Here's a Navy aircraft called TACAMO. The acronym is obscure. No one knows why it's called that. What it means is take charge and move out, okay? But this airplane's primary purpose is to be able to deal with submarines under the water, communicate with them using what we call low-frequency communications. And this is a chart that shows investment, necessary investments. What we have on the vertical axis, we have the percentage of the total defense budget. On the horizontal axis is year, from 1962 to 2050. The red block is what it costs to sustain existing forces. And so that's, when we get out to the past 22, it's relatively flat. We have a force and we're paying a certain amount of money each year to sustain it. The blue is investment. That is funds that we use to buy things to modernize the force, to buy a new ballistic missile, or to buy a new command and control airplane. And you can see that the last cycle of investment was in the 1980s. And I call this the Carter-Reagan Strategic Modernization Program, when we put a lot of the things into the force that are there today and that are now aging out. We had another big peak, and I showed you how much we were building these things in the late 50s and early 60s, a big peak of investment to get the missiles and the submarines into the force in the early 60s. So every 30 years or so, we run into this bump of investment. And you'll see that the bump out there in the 2026 timeframe is not as large as the other bumps. Now, these are corrected for the fact that they're a percentage of the defense budget. And so we're talking somewhere in the range, as I said before, heading up 3% roughly is the flat, and we're going to go up to about 5% and then come back down again. So this is the story. This is what President Obama put in place, and this is what Mr. Trump will decide whether he needs to have done. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Sobering stuff. A bunch of questions here. I was amazed to see the amount of tactical nuclear weaponry. Has there ever been a real rationale for why we should have tactical nuclear weapons? I mean, is there a way to use them that wouldn't just immediately be translated into conflagration?
Well, first you have to realize, I mean, that we were building back in the day, we had nuclear landmines. And guys would put these things on their back and they would go and blow up big bridges. That was their job, to stop the Russian advance into Western Europe. We had air defense weapons that had nuclear weapons capability. I mean, there was a time there when we were sort of absolutely dazzled. We had nuclear weapons on short-range missiles that probably would have been captured by the Russians in the initial assault if they weren't used. So Mr. Bush, one, to his credit, said, we don't need these things anymore. We had come to that realization even sooner because our military capabilities were undergoing a technological revolution so that we could achieve certain objectives without nuclear weapons. And Bush realized this, and he took 10,000 out of the force. And we spent the next 20 years dismantling them and trying to figure out how to secure the plutonium and highly enriched uranium from these weapons. I think probably it was that idea that, okay, if here's a military problem we have, what can we do nuclear to fix it? Now the issue is, how do we solve military problems using precision advanced conventional forces? And nuclear weapons are the only ones we have today are a few bombs in Europe, which could be called non-strategic, and our strategic weapons based in the United States.
What controls exist, if any, with President Trump's finger on the nuclear button? If there are none, could any be instituted? How much risk do you perceive the current political situation represents? What safeguards are there between Trump and these weapons, etc.?
Well, I mean, that's unfortunate that there's a perception out there that the president is might be fast and loose on the nuclear trigger. Here are the facts. Only the president can execute U.S. nuclear weapons. The president is being advised by his senior officials about this, obviously. If we are under an attack, back in the Cold War, the concern was that he would have to make this decision within minutes. Today, we don't think about that as being the most compelling threat, and that there would be time for the president to make certain decisions or to take steps for him to get out of Washington and survive an initial attack. There have been a couple of initiatives. Senator Markey from Massachusetts has put legislation forward that would preclude presidential use of a nuclear weapon absent concurrence from Congress. That is simply unworkable. You cannot hold the United States security hostage to a debate that may roll out for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks or more. Another idea has been, well, why don't we introduce a dual key? Why don't we assume that the president and the secretary of state and the secretary of defense would all have to agree before a U.S. nuclear weapons author? And typically, the president talking to the secretary of state, talking to the secretary of defense about any kind of crisis that would involve the potential use of nuclear weapons. And so if any one of them decided no, then we wouldn't launch. And there's precedent for that, historical precedent for that's what the Russians did. They could during the Cuban Missile Crisis. They had a submarine off Cuba, and they were getting hassled by the United States Navy. They couldn't communicate back home, and they agreed to come to a deal that said, if the captain, the executive officer, and the political control officer on the submarine all agreed that we would use them. The historical record suggests that two said yes and one said no to use it against the U.S. destroyer, that was a nuclear torpedo against a U.S. destroyer, and they never used it. I don't think any president, and I include Mr. Trump in this, is not going to employ nuclear weapons absent an enormously grave threat to the United States. I think that we have very good people in the Department of State and Department of Defense, National Security Advisor, where I think that reflects their view as well. So I understand the question. I'll make one other point. When Nixon, during Watergate years, was viewed by some of his advisors as having an element of instability, Jim Schlesinger, who was the Secretary of Defense at the time, ordered the military folks responsible for informing the president about an attack on the United States and communicating his order, an order from the president to the forces to execute nuclear weapons, that would come through him. And he wrote a memo to that effect, which I think still exists, but that memo is illegal. And nobody can tell a president not to use them. Only he can authorize them, but there's no one else who can tell him that he can't. And that's something that we've dealt with over 70 years. I understand the concerns. I understand many people have asked that question, but that's the facts right now.
What would happen if the U.S. unilaterally gave up all of its nuclear weapons? How would that play out?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, that's sort of the extreme of the idealistic view. If we just get rid of them, everybody will follow. Harold Brown, who was Secretary of Defense in the Carter administration, had a comment about the Russians was something like this: when we build, they build. When we stop, they build. So the way Mr. Putin is actually increasing his emphasis on the role of Russian nuclear weapons in Russia national security strategy, I am not at all optimistic that a unilateral U.S. decision to get rid of all of its nukes would be reciprocated.
Does President Trump understand what you've just talked about, in your opinion?
That's a very interesting question. I'm going to tell you what I know. I have a good colleague who, one of the things I do in Washington, I'm in sort of a rock rib Democrat, but I'm sort of like more like Scoop Jackson than others. I tend to be a strong national security proponent. One of the things I try to foster a bipartisan approach. So I have colleagues on the right that I interact with quite regularly to try to sort of foster a bipartisan approach with some success. And one of those guys actually was asked by Mr. Trump to come brief him about U.S. nuclear weapons. And this guy, I can't tell you his name, but this guy is a close colleague. And he was went in there and went through the story. And they had a few guys around the table. His comment to me was, he asked a lot of good questions. He understood what I was saying. And he came back with questions that indicated he understood what I was saying. Heard this also from senior military officers who briefed him in Florida during the time before he became president. We had a group of folks go down there who are overseeing the Navy and the Air the Navy and the Air Force component of our nuclear deterrent. And they had the same impression of Trump, was that he spent a lot of time with them, he listened, and he asked good questions. And so that's my data about him. It's certainly not the public persona that he conveys necessarily, But that's the only data I have with regard to folks sort of trying to inform him about what we need to do and his reaction to it, which was, I would call, not necessarily an expert, but interested, willing to absorb information about it, and asking good questions about it.
Is the scientific and military workforce to modernize nuclear arsenal in good shape, or has the talented cadre of scientists been allowed to dissipate?
Well, I think that that's a two-part answer. First of all, in the Department of Defense, we rely on a defense industrial base. Bath Iron Works up here, ships, the Boeings and Lockheeds to build fighters, to build bombers, and these companies have a long history and have been engaged all along in producing advanced military hardware, airplanes, all kinds of things. My main concern about our the skills and capabilities are with the Department of Energy part of it. The Department of Energy part of it is to basically sustain our nuclear stockpile and to assure that we can continue to sustain it without nuclear testing, if at all possible. Over the last 30 years, we have not done much original in the area of nuclear weapons. We have basically, our whole focus has been on extending the life of the ones we have. And that's more of an engineering activity than it is a science and technology and physics activity. So we're not exercising our scientists and engineers on some of the important problems that we will need if we are to retain nuclear weapons over the next 30, 40, 50 years. And so that's been my basic concern. And Congress, to its credit, has stepped up to that and instituted a couple of programs that are going to try to focus on that.
We had a number of questions about North Korea. I'll just sum them up by saying, how worried should we be, and what excuses are not to be too worried, if any?
The thing I'm most worried about is Putin right now. But North Korea is a concern. I think North Korea is not going to use nuclear weapons other than as an act of desperation. First of all, I'm going to make a bold assertion to you, that is, North Korea understands that if it ever uses nuclear weapons against South Korea or Japan or anybody, that means the end of their regime. That means the, and that's the thing they value most. That family, that isolated family that oppresses its people enormously, the only thing it really cares about, doesn't care whether its people starve or not, the only thing it cares about is that it remains in power and that it has a standard of life to what it's accustomed. And in my view, North Korea is not going to be reckless with nuclear weapons. On the other hand, if they launch a conventional attack on South Korea and they're losing and their regime comes at risk, then this idea of use of nuclear weapons as a last desperate act to preserve the regime, that's what I most worry about. We're not at that state yet.
No one that has a landmass to protect is going to enter into a nuclear exchange glibly, but you might be willing to sell nuclear assets to someone that didn't have a landmass to protect, that terrorist group.
That's the biggest concern I have with North Korea. The idea that back when they had a few nuclear weapons, they weren't going to sell them. Today, they have maybe 10 to 20, and they're ramping up. At what point does it come to the point where, hey, I really don't need this for my security, but I can really make maybe a couple $100 million if I sold one? If we think about strengthening sanctions and the things that could really hurt them right now, if China were to cut off the oil, that would really hurt. This idea and their ability to achieve foreign currency that enables them to buy and take care of the family, you wonder whether, well, would they become more likely to have an incentive to sell a nuclear weapon to be able to sustain their lifestyle? And I worry a lot about, I worry about that more than I worry about them using it in anger.
Well, everything you've said is sobering, but I want to end with a really sobering idea. Consider preemption. Consider a preemptive act against a nuclear-threatening country. Could it be nuclear? And if the preemption, could the preemption, if it needed to be nuclear? And how would the rest of the great powers react to that?
Well, I mean, should there be an option for the U.S. to try to eliminate North Korea's arsenal? Well, that's a very difficult question. Well, first of all, I would prefer another track. What I would prefer is to figure out, we don't know where they are, If we were successful in getting some of them, we wouldn't know that they might not use the others. And it's likely to provoke a conventional attack on South Korea that would be devastating. I mean, we would win that eventually. I don't believe South Korea and the United States would win that eventually. And I don't believe the U.S. would ever need to use nuclear weapons in North Korea to win a war with North Korea. We don't need nuclear weapons for that. What we need to do is figure out a way to prevent them from using them. And there are some ideas that some of us have advanced for trying to be more able to attack the left of launch problem. Now, the left of launch problem is once you've launched the missile, the right of launch problem is shoot it down with ballistic missile defenses. And we have capabilities to do that. The left of launch issue is I see the mobile missile moving along to its launch site, and I can react quickly enough to destroy it with a conventional force, with a conventional bomb, before it can be launched. I think that's the kind of capability that I would like to possess, not for preemption, but once the war starts, if it ever starts, to be able to hold at risk those nuclear assets.
John, thank you for guiding us through this horrific subject. Thank you.